and released the Pillars beta to Kickstarter backers, there was immediate criticism. "We got a lot of negative first impressions because it was so buggy, unfortunately," Brennecke said. "I think the beta needed another month to bake before we shipped it. Item descriptions were missing. Combat balance felt off. Character models would disappear when a player moved his party into a dungeon. Players were happy with the general themes and core mechanics, but the beta was so unstable it left a sour first taste." By September 2014, it had dawned on most of the Pillars of Eternity team that shipping that year would be difficult. It wasn't just the backer beta, the whole game needed more work. Obsidian needed to polish, to optimize, to spend more time zapping bugs and making sure that every area of the game felt both interesting and fun to play. "Everyone's looking at each other. No, we're not even near this. We're just not there yet," said Justin Bell, the audio director. "You have to be able to play from the beginning of the game all the way to the end and feel like it's a total experience, and that just was not even close to being the case." Adam Brennecke and Josh Sawyer asked Fergus Urquhart for a meeting. Over lunch at the Cheesecake Factory, one of Urquhart's favorite haunts, Brennecke and Sawyer explained that trying to release the game in November would be a disaster. The team needed more time. Yes, they were out of Kickstarter money and would now have to dip into Obsidian's own funds, but for a game like Pillars of Eternity, Obsidian's most important game to date, the extra investment felt necessary. Urquhart argued against it, but Brennecke and Sawyer were persistent. In their minds, the choice was already made. "Fergus sat Josh and me down," Brennecke said. He said, "If this game does not come out in March, you guys are both gone after this project." Recalling the pressure, Brennecke could only laugh. "Okay, we'll get it done." One common theme in video game development is that everything tends to come together at the last minute. There's just something about those final hours. In the last months and weeks of a game's development, chaos reigns supreme as team members scramble to polish, playtest, and fit in all the last-minute features they can think to add. Then, suddenly, something clicks. It might be the visual effects, or the audio cues, or the optimization that gets a game's frame rate as stable as possible. Usually it's all the above, a single holy moment when a game's disparate parts coalesce into something that finally feels complete. During that final stretch, the entire Pillars of Eternity team crunched non-stop to get the game out the door. Zapping bugs was particularly difficult thanks to the sheer size of the game. Obsidian's quality assurance testers had to play through all of Pillars, which could take upward of 70 or 80 hours as they tried to break the game as much as possible. They knew it would be impossible to find and fix every bug. The programmers would have to do the best they could for now, then work overtime once the game had shipped and players started sending in their own reports. One particularly malicious and random bug discovered in the days after Pillars of Eternity launched would wipe an entire character's stats if a player double-clicked on an item before equipping it. Said Josh Sawyer, "Sometimes when a game ships, you see a bug and you go, how in the world did that possibly get through?" Obsidian didn't need to worry about consoles. Pillars of Eternity was solely a computer game, but optimizing the game to run on as many different types of computers as possible became a big challenge. "We were having a lot of memory issues," said Brennecke. "The game would run out of memory a lot, so we had to figure out how to get the game stable and running on most machines." Delaying the game to March 2015 would ultimately gobble up an extra $1.5 million of the studio's money, according to Urquhart, but it was the right move. The extra time, combined with extended crunch for everyone on the Pillars team, led to a far more polished video game. On March 26, 2015, Obsidian released Pillars of Eternity. Critics loved it. "It's the most captivating, rewarding RPG I've played on a PC in years," wrote one reviewer. Outside of their Kickstarter backers, Obsidian sold over 700,000 copies of Pillars in the game's first year, exceeding most of their expectations and ensuring that a sequel would be possible right away. "The thing that was cool about this project is that it was a passion project for everyone," said Justin Bell. "And it was because of that history with Stormlands. It emerged out of the ashes of this really crappy event in Obsidian's history. And everyone was super, uber passionate about making something as special as they possibly could through the sheer force of their own will." Development on Pillars of Eternity didn't end once the game shipped, though. In the following months, the team would keep patching bugs and later release a two-part expansion, The White March. Sawyer kept working on balance patches for a year after launch, tweaking attributes and class abilities in response to fans' feedback. And the team kept interacting with backers on Kickstarter, keeping them up to date on patches and other projects Obsidian was working on. Because 80,000 people or so said they wanted this, and they gave us a new life, we were extremely respectful of that. It was really meaningful for them to give us this much money, said Rob Nessler. That was sort of a purity in this whole thing that I really hope we can do again. For just under $6 million, Obsidian had made one of 2015's best RPGs, a game that would go on to win several awards and help secure Obsidian's future as an independent studio. The company had staved off catastrophe, and it had built an intellectual property that was finally its own, with rights and royalties going to Obsidian itself rather than some big publisher. Paradox, the publisher that helped with marketing, distribution, and localization, did not own any of the rights to Pillars of Eternity. As the team passed around drinks during a lavish launch party at a Costa Mesa nightclub, Urquhart spoke to the crowd, telling them how proud and relieved he felt. Nearly 3 years ago to the day, he'd had to lay off dozens of employees, but now they could celebrate. Their gambles had paid off. They'd won. After years of uncertainty and dependence on other companies, Obsidian could finally stand on its own. In the summer of 2016, when I visited Obsidian's offices for this book, its staff were preparing to launch a crowdfunding campaign for the sequel to Pillars of Eternity. At their offices, I watched an early version of the trailer, which showcased a giant god destroying the stronghold of Cade Nua, an area that fans of the first game knew well. I listened to Obsidian's developers argue and try to find common ground over the direction of the sequel and how they would approach a second campaign. Rather than Kickstarter, they decided to put this one on Fig, a crowdfunding site that Fergus Urquhart had helped create. Obsidian wanted to return to crowdfunding not just to supplement the profits they'd made off the first Pillars, but also to maintain the spirit of an active community. As annoying as backers could be sometimes, Pillars of Eternity's developers had enjoyed interacting with fans and getting instant feedback to their work. For Pillars of Eternity 2, they wanted to take the same approach, even if they didn't anticipate getting the same kind of wild crowdfunding success. "While we can ask for money again," Urquhart told me, "we don't expect people to come out in the same levels." 6 months later, on January 26, 2017, Obsidian launched their Fig for Pillars of Eternity 2 with a goal of $1.1 million. They were funded in 22 hours and 57 minutes. At the end of the campaign, they'd raised $4,407,598, nearly half a million more than the first Pillars. This time, they didn't promise a second city. Obsidian hadn't yet solved all its money issues. Not long after launching the Fig, the studio announced that its partnership with Mail.ru had ended on the tank game Armored Warfare, and it had to lay off some staff on that team. But for Fergus Urquhart and his team of developers, figuring out how to finance their very own video game was, somehow, no longer a problem. Chapter 2 Uncharted 4 Video games, like any works of art, are reflections of their creators. The Legend of Zelda spawned from Shigeru Miyamoto's memories of childhood spelunking. Doom came out of a Dungeons & Dragons campaign in which John Romero and John Carmack allowed their fictional world to become overrun by demons. And Uncharted 4, the final entry in the Indiana Jones-style action-adventure series starring the roguish Nathan Drake, is the story of a man who spends way too much time at work. Naughty Dog, the development studio behind Uncharted, shares more than a pair of initials with its stubbled protagonist. In game industry circles, Naughty Dog has two distinct reputations. One is that its staff are the best of the best, not just at telling top-notch stories, but also at making games so eye-poppingly gorgeous, competitors publicly wonder just what kind of dark magic the studio employs. The other is that they embrace crunch. To develop games like Uncharted and The Last of Us, Naughty Dog's employees worked endless hours, staying at the office as late as 2 or 3 a.m. during extended, hellish periods of overtime that popped up before each major development milestone. All game studios crunch, but few are as known for going all out as Naughty Dog. At the start of Uncharted 4, Nathan Drake has given up his life of high-octane treasure hunting and settled into a mundane routine, spending his evenings eating noodles and playing video games with his wife Elena. It's quickly made clear, through a memorable scene in which you as Drake shoot a toy pistol at targets in the attic, that he misses the adrenaline rush of his former career. When Drake's brother resurfaces after a many years long absence, it's only a matter of time before Drake is sucked into a new treasure hunt. Then he starts lying, and gambling with his life. As Drake grapples with the reality that he's addicted to the thrill of danger, he risks alienating Elena for good. Uncharted 4 tells the story of a secret pirate society hidden out of history's view, but it also explores something more universal. How do you follow your dreams without destroying your relationships? Your life's passion sometimes isn't in line with your life's love, Neil Druckmann, the co-director of Uncharted 4, said. And sometimes those things are in conflict. In games especially, a lot of people enter the game industry because of how much they love this medium, and for us, how much we feel like we could push it and dedicate our lives to it to a large degree. But at times, if you're not careful, it can become destructive to your personal life. So there was a lot of really personal experience to draw from. You might think, after the accumulated lessons and experience of three other Uncharted games, that for Naughty Dog, Uncharted 4 would have been a walk in the park. But between a director change, a major reboot, a compressed schedule, and months of crunch, making Uncharted 4 felt more like a hike up Mount Kilimanjaro. Put another way, one of the series' running jokes is that whenever Nathan Drake jumps onto a roof or cliff, it's probably going to collapse. Toward the end of Uncharted 4's development, everyone at Naughty Dog could relate. The first Uncharted was an unusual move for Naughty Dog. Founded in 1984 by two childhood friends, Jason Rubin and Andy Gavin, the studio spent nearly two decades making platformers like Crash Bandicoot and Jak and Daxter, both of which turned into iconic franchises on Sony's PlayStation. A platformer is a genre of game in which your primary action is jumping over obstacles. Think Super Mario Brothers or Super Plumber Adventure. In 2001, Sony bought Naughty Dog, and a few years later, it charged the studio with making a game for the new PlayStation 3. Under the veteran director Amy Hennig, Naughty Dog started a project completely different from anything it had done before, a pulp adventure game inspired by the globe-trotting escapades of Indiana Jones. Players, controlling Nathan Drake, would hunt treasure and solve puzzles across the world. It was an ambitious move. For game developers, making a new intellectual property is always more difficult than developing a sequel, because there's no foundation to build on. And working on a brand new platform, especially one like the PS3 with its unfamiliar cell architecture, would make things even more complicated. Thanks to the unusual way it handled data, the PlayStation 3's cell processor was famously difficult for engineers to work with. Various developers criticized this architecture in the years following the PS3's launch, including Valve CEO Gabe Newell, who called it a waste of everybody's time in a 2007 interview with Edge magazine. 3 years later, perhaps as a mea culpa, Newell showed up at Sony's E3 press conference to announce that Portal 2 was coming to PS3. The studio had hired several talented new staff members who had Hollywood background but little experience developing games, which led to further hiccups as the rest of Naughty Dog tried to walk the newcomers through the nuances of making graphics run in real time. During particularly rough days on Uncharted, Bruce Straley, the art director, would walk over to the design department and trade complaints with his colleagues there. Straley, who had been making games since the 1990s, was frustrated with Uncharted's development and needed an outlet. Soon he was taking regular lunches with some of the designers, including an Israeli-born 20-something named Neil Druckmann, who had started at Naughty Dog as a programming intern just a couple of years earlier. Druckmann, a rising star at the studio with dark hair and olive skin, had a stubborn streak and a head for storytelling. Although he was credited only as a designer on Uncharted, Druckmann wound up helping Hennig write the game's script as well. Straley and Druckmann quickly became friends. They exchanged design ideas, commiserated about office politics, and analyzed the games they'd been playing, trying to figure out what made each level click. We started playing games at home online, so we were still talking to each other and kicking around stuff even in multiplayer games, Straley said. That's where the work relationship started forming. Uncharted came out in 2007. Shortly afterward, Naughty Dog bumped Straley up to game director, under Amy Hennig, who's creative director, giving him more control over the design of Uncharted 2, which shipped in 2009. Then, as the bulk of Naughty Dog moved to Uncharted 3, Straley and Druckmann broke off from the Uncharted team to try something new. In November 2011, when Uncharted 3 hit store shelves, work was underway on Straley and Druckmann's first project as co-directors, a post-apocalyptic adventure called The Last of Us. It was a wild departure from the Uncharted series. Where Uncharted took after Tintin, The Last of Us would feel more like Cormac McCarthy's The Road. Where the Uncharted games were breezy and funny, The Last of Us would open with a soldier shooting and killing the main character's 12-year-old daughter. But the goal wasn't just to make people cry. Straley and Druckmann watched movies like No Country for Old Men and wondered why so many video games had the subtlety of a sledgehammer. Why, they thought, couldn't their characters leave some thoughts unsaid? In The Last of Us, the disease-infected zombies and ruined roads of America would exist only to serve the story of their two main characters. Every scene and encounter would deepen the relationship between Joel, a grizzled mercenary, and Ellie, a teenage girl who becomes his proxy daughter as they travel. Where other games might have gone for the jugular,
"Wow, Ellie, you sure do fill the emotional void left by my dead daughter,"
The Last of Us trusted players to fill in the blanks themselves. Of course, it's easier to decide that you want to tell a subtle story than it is to, you know, tell a subtle story. For the second time in a decade, Bruce Straley and Neil Druckmann discovered that starting a new intellectual property from scratch could be an excruciating process. And up until the very end, they thought The Last of Us would be a disaster. "It was the hardest project that I'd ever worked on in my life," Straley said. He and Druckmann battled constantly as they tried to figure out how to balance poignant emotional beats with vicious zombie shootouts. They struggled with everything from the cover system to the story's finale. Focus testers would suggest that they add more video gamey elements, boss battles, ultra-powerful weapons, special enemy classes. But Straley and Druckmann stuck with their vision, even as early testers warned them that reviews might be mediocre. Reviews were not mediocre. In June 2013, when The Last of Us came out, fans and critics wouldn't stop raving. It was the most successful game in Naughty Dog's history, turning Straley and Druckmann into game development rock stars and ensuring that they'd be project leads at Naughty Dog for as long as they wanted to be. During those same years, from 2011 to 2014, Amy Hennig spent her days working with a small team on Uncharted 4. They had some ideas for how to switch things up. They wanted to add vehicles for one, maybe a grappling hook. And most surprisingly, they wanted to have Nathan Drake go half the game without picking up a gun. Critics had called out previous Uncharted games for the dissonance between their stories, in which Drake is an amiable, fun-loving hero, and their gameplay, in which Drake can murder thousands of enemy soldiers without missing a beat. Hennig and her team thought it might be an interesting twist for Drake to stick to melee for a while, to show that the puckish adventurer could change his ways. Uncharted 4, as Hennig envisioned it, would introduce the world to Nathan Drake's old partner, Sam. We hadn't seen Sam in previous Uncharted games, because for 15 years Nathan had thought he was dead, left behind during a Panamanian prison escape gone awry. In Hennig's version of Uncharted 4, Sam would be one of the main villains, bitter toward Nathan for leaving him to die. Over the course of the story, as Nathan tried to pull away from his roots as a treasure hunter, the player would find out that he and Sam were actually brothers. Eventually, they'd heal their relationship and unify against the game's real antagonist, a nasty thief named Rafe, voiced by the actor Warren Cole, who had served time with Sam in prison. But Uncharted 4 was struggling. Naughty Dog's vision of itself as a two-team studio, able to develop two different games simultaneously, turned out to be too idealistic. Throughout 2012 and 2013, the Last of Us team needed to dragoon more and more of Uncharted 4's developers, leaving Hennig with just a skeleton staff. "We were hoping that we'd have two completely staffed teams," said Naughty Dog's co-president Evan Wells. "They just sort of leapfrogged each other, and we just couldn't hire enough talent fast enough to keep up with the demands of the game's expansion in terms of expectation of scope. At best, we maybe got to 1.5, or probably more like 1.25 teams." At the beginning of 2014, as Neil Druckmann and Bruce Straley finished up work on an expansion for The Last of Us called Left Behind, the studio went into emergency mode, calling several meetings in an attempt to diagnose the problems with Uncharted 4. There are conflicting perspectives on what happened next. Some say the Uncharted 4 team didn't get the staff and resources it needed to survive because The Last of Us and Left Behind had vacuumed up so much of Naughty Dog's attention. Others say that Amy Hennig had trouble making decisions and that the nascent game wasn't shaping up very well. Some who were working on Uncharted 4 wished that there was a more cohesive direction. Others thought it was perfectly understandable, considering how small the Uncharted 4 staff was, that the game hadn't coalesced yet. One part of the story is indisputable, however. In March 2014, after meeting with Naughty Dog's co-presidents, Wells and Christophe Balestra, Amy Hennig exited the studio and didn't come back. Hennig's creative partner Justin Richmond left shortly afterward, as did a few other veterans who had worked closely with Hennig. "It's something that happens at different levels," said Wells. "It happened to happen at a fairly high level. But we have turnover for various reasons throughout the studio. And Amy's a friend of mine. I really miss her and I wish her well, but things weren't working out. So we went our separate ways, and we had to pick up the pieces. The day after Hennig's departure, the gaming website IGN reported, citing anonymous sources, that Neil Druckmann and Bruce Straley had pushed her out. In public comments afterward, Naughty Dog's leadership vehemently disputed that account, calling it unprofessionally misreported. The studio didn't elaborate further, and Hennig remained quiet about what had gone down. It was hurtful to get those rumors published out there, because we saw our employees' names being attached to that when they weren't involved in that process at all, Wells later told me. But several people who have worked for Naughty Dog say Druckmann and Straley stopped seeing eye to eye with Hennig, and that they had fundamental disagreements on where to take the Uncharted series. When Hennig left, she signed a non-disparagement agreement with the studio that would prevent both her and Naughty Dog from making negative public comments about what had happened, according to people familiar with the arrangement. Hennig declined to be interviewed for this book. Immediately after Hennig's departure, Evan Wells and Christoph Balestra called Neil Druckmann and Bruce Straley into a meeting to tell them that she was gone. Straley felt what he later described as a sinking feeling in my gut, as he realized what they were about to say next. I think I said, "So what does this mean? Who's heading up Uncharted 4?" Straley said. And that's where they said, kind of nervously, "That's where you come in." After the massive critical and commercial success of The Last of Us, Druckmann and Straley were the studio's golden boys. And now they had to make a decision. Did they want to spend the next year of their lives with Nathan Drake? It wasn't an easy question to answer. The directing pair had thought they were done with Uncharted for good. Both Druckmann and Straley wanted to work on other games. They'd been playing around with prototypes for a sequel to The Last of Us, and Straley in particular was feeling burned out. "I had just worked on one of the hardest projects, the hardest project that I'd ever worked on in my life with The Last of Us," Straley said. He wanted to spend the next few months relaxing, prototyping, and brainstorming without the stress of immutable deadlines. Moving immediately to Uncharted 4, which had been in production for over 2 years and was scheduled to ship just a year later, in 2015, would be like running a marathon and then hopping over to the Summer Olympics. But what other choice did they have? "Uncharted 4 needed help," said Straley. "It was in a bad state in regards to the lines of communication, the pipeline, what people were doing. And it didn't feel like it was making the positive forward progress it needed. So how did I feel? Not great. It's not a great position to be in, but I also believe in the Naughty Dog name. I believe in the team." In Straley's mind, he and Druckmann could maybe come on board for a few months, steer everyone toward a single direction, and then hop off to work on other projects, letting other design leads take the wheel once the ship was moving. Druckmann and Straley said they'd do it on one condition. They needed full creative control. They weren't interested in finishing the story that Hennig had started, and while they'd try to salvage some of the characters, like Sam and Rafe, and environments, big areas in Scotland and Madagascar, they'd also have to throw out a lot of work that Uncharted 4's team had done so far. They would need to scrap a great deal of cutscenes, voice work, and animation, which the studio had spent millions of dollars developing. Would Naughty Dog really be okay with that? "Yes," said Wells and Balestra. "Do it." Right away, Druckmann and Straley made a decision that they thought might court controversy. Uncharted 4 would be the last Uncharted game, or at least the last one starring Nathan Drake. The studio had been mulling this option under Hennig, but now it was official. "We looked at the previous games," said Druckmann. "We looked at the arcs, looked at where Nathan Drake was at, what kind of stories are still left to tell, and the only one that came to our mind was the final one. How do we take him out?" It was a move that few other studios could pull off. What self-respecting video game publisher would put an end to a lucrative series just when it was at its peak? As it turned out, Sony would. Years of success had afforded Naughty Dog the cachet to do whatever it wanted to do, even if that meant saying goodbye to Nathan Drake for good. Plus, Sony could always make more Uncharted games with other characters. Uncharted 4 had already been in development for roughly 2 years. But because Straley and Druckmann were changing so much of what Hennig had done, it felt to the two directors like they were starting from scratch. "It was daunting," said Straley. "We couldn't take what was there, because that was part of the problem. There was a breakdown both in the gameplay and the story side of things. Both sides needed a lot of work. It was red alert, all systems go, panic, freak out. How the hell are we going to do this mode? After being burnt out on The Last of Us and crunching there." The directing pair talked often about feeding the beast, a term they'd picked up from the Pixar book Creativity Inc. that referred to a creative team's insatiable hunger for work. With The Last of Us done, there were now nearly 200 people working on Uncharted 4, and they all needed things to do. As soon as Straley and Druckmann took over, they had to make fast decisions. Yes, they were keeping Scotland and Madagascar. Yes, there would still be a prison flashback. The directing pair met with the leads in each department, art, design, programming, and so forth, to ensure that their team still had work to do every day, despite the turmoil. "It was really stressful," said Druckmann. "Sometimes you feel like you don't have the proper time to consider choices, and you just have to make those choices and say, well, if we get them 80% right, then we'll be better off than trying to take the time to get them 100% right, because meanwhile the team is just sitting idly by, waiting for that section." Many at Naughty Dog were frazzled by these sudden changes, especially those who had been working on Uncharted 4 since the beginning. Although it helped to hear that Straley and Druckmann wanted to maintain as much of their work as possible, the thought of losing years' worth of progress was nauseating to some on the staff. "Each decision was sometimes a stab in the heart," said Jeremy Yates, a lead animator. "Oh, I can't believe we're cutting this thing that me or someone else had spent literally months working out." It was definitely a hard transition, but every time you do it, if you're honest and you look back at it, then you know what? That was the right decision. This is a better game because of it. It's more focused, more clear. "The transition went relatively well and quickly," said Tate Mozesian, a lead environment artist. "They had a plan, a clear plan, and they expressed it to the team. It instilled confidence. As sad as it was to see the team that had such a long history with the franchise leaving, we could see the future and the light at the end of the tunnel." Over the next few weeks, Straley and Druckmann sat in a conference room and stared at index cards, trying to craft a new version of Uncharted 4's story. They decided to keep Nathan Drake's brother Sam, but they wanted to make him less of a villain. Instead, he'd serve as a temptation, as the catalyst that got Nathan Drake out of domesticity and back to his treasure-hunting ways. They kept the antagonist Rafe, too, writing him as a rich, spoiled brat who was fueled by jealousy for Drake's success. During this process, Straley and Druckmann brought in a rotation of designers and co-writers, both to help plot the story and so they'd get a feel for who could replace them as directors when they eventually left the project. For weeks, they'd meet in the same room, assembling index cards on a big board that became their Uncharted 4 Bible. Each index card contained a story beat or scene idea. One mid-game sequence, for example, was just called Epic Chase, and taken together, they told the game's entire narrative. "One thing we've never done here is sat down and written down an entire script for the whole game start to front," said Josh Scher, a writer who sat with Straley and Druckmann for many of these meetings. "That never happens. And the reason it doesn't happen is because game design is an iterative process, and if you do that, you're just asking for heartbreak when things inevitably change because the gameplay doesn't work out the way you expected it to, or you have a better idea further down the line, or anything like that. You have to be able to be flexible." Over the next few weeks, Druckmann and Straley put together a 2-hour presentation that outlined their vision for Uncharted 4, then showed it to the rest of Naughty Dog. "This was a story about addiction," they explained. "At the beginning of the game, Nathan Drake would be working a standard day job and living peacefully with his longtime partner Elena, although it would soon become clear that Drake felt unsatisfied. Sam would reemerge shortly afterward, dragging Drake into a convoluted adventure that would take them all across the world through massive gunfights and deadly car escapes on their hunt for a treasure-filled pirate city. There would be quiet flashbacks as well as the big explosive set pieces that fans would expect from an Uncharted game. We'd see Drake lying to Elena. We'd see Elena find out. And it would all end in Libertalia, the buried city, where Drake and crew would discover that what they thought was a pirate utopia was actually a haven of greed and paranoia. This would be a large game, bigger than anything Naughty Dog had done to date. And they were still hoping to release it in the fall of 2015, a year and a half away. For the developers, it was helpful to see the roadmap for what Uncharted 4 would ultimately look like, but the amount of work was scary. Some people were pretty burnt out already," said Druckmann. "They were a little afraid of how ambitious this looked, and it took a while to re-inspire them to this vision." It helped that E3 was coming up soon. Some game studios saw trade shows as distractions, existing only for pomp, sizzle, and marketing copy. But Naughty Dog viewed E3 as a valuable milestone. They'd usually get a prime spot at Sony's annual press conference, and it was common for dozens of staffers to trek from Naughty Dog's Santa Monica offices to the Los Angeles Convention Center to attend the show. Every year, Naughty Dog developers would leave E3 feeling newly energized by the reactions to whatever slick new games they were showing. E3 in June 2014 was no exception. At the end of the PlayStation press conference, when Sony's president Andrew House came out for one final teaser and the words Naughty Dog appeared on screen, fans erupted. In the teaser, a wounded Nathan Drake staggered through the jungle as a voiceover conversation with his longtime partner Sully made it clear that this was going to be their final adventure. Then came the title, Uncharted 4, A Thief's End. Druckmann and Straley knew they weren't going to kill Nathan Drake, but they sure wanted fans to think they would, which led to all sorts of fun buzzing. As Naughty Dog's developers prepared for what they all knew would be a grueling development cycle, they scoured sites like YouTube and NeoGAF for fans' reactions, drawing energy from the hype. Then they got back to work. Sony's big new fan convention, PlayStation Experience, or PSX, would take place in December 2014. To help kick off the inaugural PSX, the Naughty Dog team had agreed to put together an extensive gameplay demo for Uncharted 4, which meant they had just a few months to figure out what a slice of the final game would look like. Naughty Dog, like many experienced studios, bought into the mentality that there was no way to know whether part of a game was fun until you played it. So, like other studios, they would build little gray box areas, self-contained spaces where all the 3D models looked monochromatic and ugly because there was no proper art attached, and test out their design ideas to see which ones felt good to play. For designers, the upside of this prototype period is that they can experiment with new ideas without risking much time or money, though the downside is that very few of those ideas will make the cut. During the Amy Hennig years, the team had tinkered with all sorts of gray box prototypes for Uncharted 4. There was a slide mechanic that would allow Drake to propel forward, Mega Man style. There were cliff walls that Drake could shoot and then scale, using the bullet holes as handholds to climb his way up. There was a scene in an Italian auction house in which the player could switch among multiple characters, hunting for clues as Drake and crew attempted to steal an artifact without drawing suspicion from the crowd. At one point during this auction house sequence, Drake and Elena would have to dance across a fancy ballroom, maneuvering closer and closer to the artifact as the player pressed buttons along with the beat of the music, sort of like you would in a rhythm game. Think Dance Dance Revolution, minus the jumping. In theory, this dancing mechanic might have been awesome, but in practice it wasn't really working. When you talk about, okay, let's have this fun dancing gameplay, it doesn't really fit with anything else, and it has to be deep enough and fun enough by itself to exist, said Amelia Schatz, a lead designer. So it went by the wayside. The team considered salvaging the dance mechanic for an early scene in which Drake and Elena are eating dinner at home, a scene that's meant to display the state of their relationship after the past three Uncharted games, but watching them dance felt too awkward. It wasn't really fun, said Schatz. A big goal of the level was try to make the player relate to these people, show their relationship. Not a whole lot of people dance in their living room like that. Later, someone had the idea that Drake and Elena should instead play a video game, and after some quick license negotiations, Naughty Dog snuck in a copy of the original Crash Bandicoot, which made for a nice moment as the couple traded barbs over a PlayStation 1. Bruce Straley and Neil Druckmann knew that many of those early gray box prototypes didn't mesh with their vision. Straley believed in designing around a set of core mechanics, or basic actions that a player would perform throughout the game, and limiting those mechanics to what was essential. That was a thing that I needed to do more than anything, was pin down what the core mechanics were going to be, Straley said. Sifting through the prototypes and seeing what was going to work and what wasn't, what scales, what works with something else. For Straley, harmony was key. Prototypes that might have seemed cool in a vacuum, like ballroom dancing, wouldn't always work nicely with the vibe of the game. There was a bunch of what I call theory craft, Straley said. There's a bunch of ideas that work on paper or when you're talking over lunch, wouldn't it be cool if moments, but when you try to test them in the game, they fall apart quickly. In addition to the basics of Uncharted, jumping, climbing, shooting, Straley and his team picked out two main prototypes for their deck of core mechanics. One was the drivable truck, which had been cut and re-added to Uncharted 4 several times over the years. The second was the rope and grappling hook, which Drake could use to climb heights and swing across gaps. This rope went through dozens of iterations. At one point, the player would have to pull it out, wind it up, and aim it at a specific location on the map, which Straley found cumbersome. So he and the designers kept iterating until they transformed it into a single button press, one you could use only when you were within range of a hookable location. In game design, even a question as simple as, how do you know when you can use the grappling hook, can lead to all sorts of complicated discussions. Although Naughty Dog's designers were originally averse to putting an icon on the screen to indicate that you could use the rope, they hated user interface, UI, elements that felt too video gamey, they eventually relented. "People just start spamming the button everywhere if there's no icon," said Kurt Marginau, a lead designer. "Can I rope to that?" "Nope, can't rope to that." "We made it more accessible and faster and more reliable," said Straley. The grappling hook that was there wasn't going to be able to couple with combat, because it was so arduous in its implementation that you couldn't do it quickly. It wasn't responsive. "When you're getting shot at, you need things to be instant, otherwise you hate the game." They also wanted to add more sneaking, which had worked in The Last of Us, and which the team thought might be a good fit for Uncharted 4. It made more sense for Nathan Drake to creep around environments, scoping out enemies and taking them out one by one, than it did for him to go on a rampage with his machine gun out. But there were a lot of questions to answer. What would a typical level layout look like? How open would each area be? Would Drake be able to sneak up behind enemies and take them down? What sort of tools would he have for distracting or eliminating guards without getting caught? Many of the levels that the Uncharted 4 team had already built were designed according to the early notion that Drake wouldn't be able to use guns, which Straley and Druckmann had abandoned. As the team prepared for PlayStation Experience, where they'd show off Uncharted 4's gameplay for the first time, they needed to make a lot of big changes. There was a more pressing question, though. Were Neil Druckmann and Bruce Straley going to direct the whole game? Moving directly from the grueling development of The Last of Us to production on Uncharted 4 had felt, as Eric Pangilinan, one of the two art directors, described it, like you just came from Afghanistan and then you've heard about Iraq. Both Druckmann and Straley were feeling drained. "Our initial idea was that we were going to come on and mentor people into game director and creative director positions, and we were going to back off," said Straley. "It wasn't going to be our project at all. Maybe then they'd take a long vacation, or spend their days on less stressful work, like the prototype experiments they'd wanted to make way back when The Last of Us shipped." That never happened. As PSX 2014 drew closer and closer, it began dawning on Straley that they couldn't leave. The developers that he and Druckmann had eyed for leadership roles weren't stepping up for various reasons, and Straley felt like he and Druckmann were the only ones in a position to fine-tune many of the game's core mechanics. Climbing, for example. Several designers had spent months developing an elaborate climbing system that involved a mixture of slippery and unstable handholds. On its own, it was lifelike and fun to play with, but in the larger context of Uncharted 4, when you were trying to leap from cliff to cliff in the middle of an intense combat encounter, there was nothing more frustrating than slipping to your death because you pressed the wrong button. So Straley put it on hold, much to the dismay of the designers who had spent months scaling climbing walls and researching hardcore mountaineering techniques. "That was probably a turning point for me," said Straley. "I had to make those kinds of decisions to craft a demo that would create hype and energy and create a section of the game that people would see the game for what it is. That had to be that demo, and it had to be myself and Neil making those decisions. That was the turning point, I think, for me, which got me to say, okay, I've just got to see this through." By PSX, two things were clear. One was that Uncharted 4 was not going to come out in 2015. Naughty Dog's bosses had hashed it out with Sony and agreed to a new ship date in March 2016. Even that date seemed dicey to some members of the team, but at least they'd have another full year to finish the game. The second thing that became clear at the end of 2014 was that Neil Druckmann and Bruce Straley were stuck with Nathan Drake until the very end. Most game projects have a single lead. Whether they call themselves creative director, a la Josh Sawyer on Pillars of Eternity, or executive producer, like Dragon Age Inquisition's Mark Dara, whom we'll meet in Chapter 6, the one thing they all have in common is that they always get the final call. In the case of creative conflicts and disagreements, the buck stops with that single guy or gal. In the video game industry, sadly, the former has severely outnumbered the latter. Druckmann and Straley were an exception. On both The Last of Us and Uncharted 4, they served as co-directors, which made for an unusual dynamic. They complemented each other well. Druckmann loved writing dialogue and working with actors, while Straley spent most of his days helping the team hone gameplay mechanics. But they still squabbled as much as you might expect from two ambitious, creative, alpha-type personalities. "It's like a real relationship, like a marriage," said Druckmann. "Like Drake and Elena. Who's Drake and who's Elena? I'm probably Elena." Since their days swapping complaints over lunch during the first Uncharted, the directing pair had developed a unique rapport. We try to work by just being as honest as we can with each other, Druckmann said. When we don't like something, we let each other know right away. When a big decision is being made for the game, we make sure to loop each other in, so no one is surprised by something. When they disagreed on something, they'd each rank how they felt about it, on a scale from 1 to 10. If Druckmann was at an 8, but Straley said he was just a 3, Druckmann would get his way. But if they were both in the 9s or 10s? Then we have to go in one of the offices, close the door, and be like, okay, why do you feel so strongly about this, said Druckmann. Sometimes those can become hours-long conversations, until we finally both get on the same page and say, okay, this is what it should be. Where we end up might be not even those two choices that we started out with. It was an unorthodox management style, which was something of a tradition at the studio behind Uncharted. Naughty Dog staff liked to emphasize that, unlike other game studios, they didn't have producers. Nobody's job was simply to manage the schedule or coordinate people's work, the role a producer would fill at other companies. Instead, everyone at Naughty Dog was expected to manage him or herself. At another studio, a programmer who had an idea for a feature might be expected to book a request with a producer before talking to his colleagues. At Naughty Dog, the programmer could just get up, walk across the room, and tell the designers what he thought. This freedom could lead to chaos, like the time Druckmann and Straley each designed different versions of the same scene, costing themselves weeks of work because they hadn't talked for a few days. With dedicated producers, that might not have happened. But to Naughty Dog's management, this approach was best. The amount of time you lose to those rare occasions is far surpassed by the amount of efficiency you get, said Evan Wells. Rather than calling a meeting and discussing the validity of it and then getting approval and putting on a schedule, all that lost time is just not worth it. During the development of Uncharted 4, as Naughty Dog grew bigger than it had ever been, Christoph Balestra, one of the company's co-presidents, designed a computer program called Tasker that helped the studio organize daily tasks and fixes. When we were trying to finalize a level, there were these checklists that you need to fix every single one of these problems, and that ended up being crucial, said Anthony Newman, a lead designer. Perhaps because of this unusual structure, Naughty Dog took an abnormal approach to detail. If you look closely at any scene in Uncharted 4, you'll spot something extraordinary. The creases on Drake's shirt, the stitches on his buttons, the way he pulls the leather strap over his head when he equips a rifle. These details didn't pop up out of the ether. They emerged from a studio full of people obsessive enough to add them to the game, even if it meant staying at the office until 3 a.m. We'll take it as far as we possibly can, said Phil Kovats, the audio lead. We all wanted to make sure that, because this was the last Nathan Drake game we were making, it was going to go out with as much stuff as we possibly could. Nowhere was this more evident than their E3 demo, which became the Uncharted 4 team's biggest milestone as they entered 2015, following a successful showcase at PSX. This would be the epic chase from their index cards, a wild ride through the streets of a fictional city in Madagascar, showcasing the game's complicated new vehicles and explosions. In the weeks leading up to E3, Uncharted 4's artists and designers worked non-stop hours trying to make everything click. Once a week, and sometimes once a day, the whole E3 team would meet up in the theater to go over their progress. They'd review which mechanics weren't working, which effects required more polish, and which non-player character needed to be moved slightly to the left. Basically, everyone working on the sequence was in there, so the communication was very direct, said Anthony Newman, a lead designer. Bruce and Neil would just play and say, this is a problem, this is a problem, this is a problem. The demo started off in a crowded marketplace, where Drake and Sully would get caught in a shootout, gun down a few mercenaries, and then flee from an armored tank. Climbing their way across buildings, they'd escape to a car they'd parked nearby. This would be an opportunity for Naughty Dog to dazzle fans with the new mechanics. Hey, look, an Uncharted game with driving in it. And as the demo progressed, Drake and Sully would skid frantically through a tangle of old streets, crashing through fences and fruit stands as they tried to shake off enemy vehicles. Then they'd find Sam, caught up in his own epic chase as the bad guys tried to run him off the road. Drake would tell Sully to take the wheel, then hurl up his rope and attach it to a passing truck, dangling next to the highway at 60 miles per hour. Waylon Brink, a technical art director, recalled spending hours and hours fashioning the grain sacks in the marketplace so that when mercenaries shot them, it'd look like they were deflating. Then the grain would start spraying out and forming neatly organized piles on the floor. It was the type of detail that some studios might see as an unnecessary waste of resources. But to Naughty Dog's artists, the extra hours were worth it. That is a moment now that people remember, and it wasn't an accident, said Tate Mosesian, a lead environment artist. From a gameplay standpoint, we try to hit these moments or these beats that help draw the player through. And oftentimes it's something as big as a collapsing building or as small as a grain sack deflating. The demo looked incredible, and it turned out to be one of the most exciting parts of Uncharted 4. So in retrospect, maybe Naughty Dog shouldn't have shown so much of it at E3. But that's a question all developers have to ask. How do you convince fans that your game will be awesome without spoiling the best parts? We were worried that we might be showing the coolest set piece in the game, said Druckmann, but it felt like it was the one that was furthest along. At the same time, you're trying to balance that with getting people excited and making sure you're going to sell this game. That approach was effective, and Naughty Dog staff were again inspired by the positive E3 buzz, which they'd need to get through the coming months. By July 2015, everyone on Uncharted 4 was already feeling burned out. The weeks leading up to E3 had been a mess of late nights and weekends at the office, and everyone knew that the schedule wasn't going to get easier. Many of them had gone from crunching on The Last of Us to crunching on Uncharted, with few breaks or vacations in between. I think everybody off of that demo was just thinking, do whatever you can do to just show up every day and just get the job done, said Bruce Straley. I know that there were feelings inside where I was thinking, how do you muster the courage and the will just to keep going? Because nobody else is. Everybody on the team, it felt like, was running on fumes. Straley lived on the east side of Los Angeles, so it took him at least an hour to get to Naughty Dog's Santa Monica office. During Uncharted 4's crunch, when he wanted to arrive at work first thing in the morning and stay until 2 or 3 a.m., he began worrying that the drive was excessively time-consuming and maybe even kind of dangerous, so he rented a second apartment near the office. He'd stay there during the week, then go home on weekends. It was close enough that I wasn't really a danger to my life, and I could come in early without traffic, he said. And so Bruce Straley, who had once thought that he'd be on Uncharted 4 for only a few months, now found himself living at a strange new apartment just to finish the game. The word crunch calls to mind the gnashing of teeth, which is a fitting descriptor for the feeling of working endless hours on a big-budget video game. For decades, extended overtime has been a ubiquitous practice, seen as integral to game development as buttons or computers. It's also been controversial. Some argue that crunch represents failure of leadership and project management, that for employees to spend months working 14-hour days, usually for no extra money, is unconscionable. Others wonder how games can be made without it. We crunch on all of our games for sure, said Naughty Dog's co-president Evan Wells. It's never mandated. We never say, okay, it's 6 days a week, okay, it's 60 hours a week. We never change our 40-hour expectation or our core hours, which are 10:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. People put in a lot more hours, but it's based on their own fuel, how much they have in their tank. Of course, there was always a cascading effect. When one designer stayed late to finish a level, others would feel pressured to stay late too. Every Naughty Dog employee knew that the company had certain standards of quality, and that hitting those standards would always mean putting in overtime. Besides, what self-respecting artist wouldn't want to milk every hour to make his or her work as good as possible? It's certainly a hot topic, and one that I don't want to dismiss as unimportant, but I feel that it's never going to go away, said Wells. You can mitigate it. You can try to make it less impactful in the long term, make sure people have the chance to recuperate and recover from it, but I think it's the nature of an artistic endeavor, where there's no blueprint for making a game. You're constantly reinventing the product. That was the biggest problem. Reinventing the product. Even on the fourth entry in a series that Naughty Dog had been making for a decade, it was still impossible to plot out just how long everything would take. The problem is, you couldn't task creativity, said Bruce Straley. You can't task fun. How could the designers know, without weeks of playtesting and iterating, whether the new stealth mechanics were worth keeping? How could the artists know, without weeks of optimization, whether those snazzy, beautiful environments would run at a proper frame rate? And how could the programmers know, until everything was finished, just how many bugs they'd have to mop up by the end of the game? At Naughty Dog, as at all game studios, the answer was always to estimate. And then when those estimates invariably turned out to be too conservative, the answer was to crunch. To solve crunch, probably the best you could do is say, don't try to make Game of the Year, said Neil Druckmann. Don't do that, and you're good. Druckmann, like many veteran designers, viewed crunch as a complex issue. Naughty Dog was a studio full of perfectionists, he argued. Even if their managers tried to tell their employees to go home by 7 o'clock p.m., everyone on the team would fight to stay late and polish their game until the very last second. With Uncharted 4, we tried even earlier than we'd ever done to say, here's the entire story, beginning to end, here are all the beats, Druckmann said. And what we find is that instead of shrinking crunch, we just make a more ambitious game, and people work just as hard as the previous game. So we're still trying to figure out how to find that better work-life balance. Eric Pangilinan's solution was to put in long hours every night. I usually go home at 2 a.m, he said, but never to work on weekends. I'm very strict about that. Others sacrificed their health and well-being for the sake of the project. One Naughty Dog designer later tweeted that he'd gained 15 pounds during Uncharted 4's final crunch. And some worried during those last few months of 2015 that the game might never be finished. The crunch at the end was probably the worst we've ever had, said Amelia Schatz. It was honestly very unhealthy. We've done bad crunches before, but I never got the feeling we couldn't finish this project. Toward the end of Uncharted 4, you'd see other people in the hall and there'd be that look, I don't know how we're going to finish this, it just doesn't seem possible. There was just so much work to do. They still had levels to finish, set pieces to tweak, art to polish. Catastrophes would occasionally impede their progress, like the time the studio's servers kept crashing because Naughty Dog was uploading hundreds of thousands of humongous asset files per day. It's not fun to debug those kinds of problems, said Christian Gerling, a lead programmer. At the center of all of our networking is the file server, and if you try to inspect what's going on, it's like taking a fire hose to the face of information. And somewhere in that stream of information, you have to deduce which machine is it that's causing things to go wrong. Even with the bulk of the Uncharted 4 team working extended hours for 5 days a week, if not 6 or 7, the finish line seemed miles away. As more of the game came together, it became clear which parts needed improvement, but it was difficult for team members to know what to prioritize. There were a lot of leads meetings at the end where we were just reminding everybody, perfect is the enemy of good, said the writer Josh Scher. You're polishing something that's at 95% while this thing over here at 60% needs a lot of love. So that was what made crunch hard, because when you'd get down to it, you'd have trouble seeing the forest for the trees. In the last months of production, Neil Druckmann and Bruce Straley decided to cut one of the team's favorite set pieces, a sequence in Scotland during which Drake would climb a giant crane, then try to escape as it collapsed, fighting off enemies as he went. The designers had made an elaborate prototype for this crane sequence, and they all thought it'd be an exciting spectacle, but they just didn't have enough time to get it finished. "We had that all working in a prototype form," said Evan Wells. "But then just the sheer amount of polish it takes to take that prototype to completion... You hit FX and sound and animation. It hits every single department in so many ways, and it might take you a few days to put that prototype together, but it's going to take you a few months to really complete it." Druckmann and Straley also started ramping up their focus tests. Participants in these tests, usually a diverse group of LA residents with varying amounts of gaming knowledge, would stroll into the office and assemble at a row of desks, each equipped with a pair of headphones and the latest build of Uncharted 4. As these testers played through multi-hour sessions of the game, faces glowing from the pale blue light of their monitors, Naughty Dog's designers could watch everything. They could gauge testers' physical reactions through a camera hooked up to the testing room, and see exactly what each tester was playing at any given time. Naughty Dog's designers could even annotate the footage, sticking in relevant notes like, "died 10 times here," or "face seemed bored." During that final stretch, these focus tests became even more important to Druckmann and Straley. As Uncharted 4 morphed from a collection of prototypes and gray box levels into an actual game, the directing pair could start pinpointing big picture problems like tone and pacing. After nearly 2 years with the game, Straley and Druckmann had lost all semblance of objectivity, which was why testers were so important. "They might not get certain mechanics," said Druckmann. "They might be lost for a while and lose all sense of pacing. They might be confused by the story and not pick up on certain nuances that you thought were pretty clear and wound up not being clear at all." Bits of individual feedback weren't that helpful. What if that bored tester was just having a bad day? So instead, Naughty Dog's leads looked for trends. Were a lot of people getting stuck on the same encounter? Did everyone think one section of the game was too boring? "The first few focus tests are really humbling," said Druckmann. "Bruce and I now get excited by them because it just puts everything into perspective. They're brutal, and you feel defeated. And a lot of times the designers hate watching levels being played, and they're pulling their hair out. 'No, turn around! The handhold is right there! What are you doing?' And you can't do anything." By the end of 2015, Uncharted 4's deadline looked terrifying. To hit its scheduled release date of March 18, 2016, Naughty Dog would have to submit its Gold Master in mid-February. A Gold Master, or Release to Manufacturing build, is a version of a game that's sent to the publisher, in Uncharted 4's case, Sony, to produce discs and distribute the game to store shelves. Fixing all the highest priority bugs by February felt like it'd be an impossible task, and everyone at the studio was consumed by anxiety that the team might not get it done. You always have that sinking feeling in your stomach, that you just don't know how it's going to pan out, said Evan Wells. You just know, well, we've got 3 months. And you start looking back at old bug reports that you had in your last game. 3 months out, how many bugs did we have? How many were A-level bugs? When a game company is fixing bugs, the development team goes through a process called triage, in which it labels each error based on how significant it is. The highest A or 1-level bugs are usually the ones that break a game entirely. If you find a bug in a video game, the developers have probably found it too. It's just a C-level bug that nobody had the time or inclination to fix before launch. How many were we fixing every day? Okay, we were fixing 50 a day, so we start running all those calculations like, all right, we're not totally screwed. It helped that they were running focus tests every week. As they fixed more and more bugs, which ranged from major, game crashes every time you shoot in the wrong place, to minor, it's hard to tell that you should jump here, the focus testers would give the game higher and higher ratings. And Naughty Dog staff kept pushing themselves, working longer hours than they'd ever worked before to get Uncharted 4 in shape. Problem was, they were running out of time. We started saying, okay, well, we're going to have to patch, said Wells, referring to the increasingly common practice of releasing a day one patch to fix bugs that have made it onto the Gold Master. When we put something on a disc, it's not going to be a completely polished Naughty Dog experience, and we're going to use those 3 to 4 weeks between printing the discs and it landing on the shelves to put that polish in. In other words, anyone who bought Uncharted 4 and played it without connecting to the internet and downloading the patch would get an inferior version of the game. We started trying to prepare Sony. Okay, we're going to have a pretty big day one patch, said Wells. Things are not looking too smooth. We're going to come in pretty hot. As Sony's engineers started preparing to expedite the patching process for Naughty Dog, word started getting around the company that Uncharted 4 was on shaky ground. And eventually, the news reached the very top. One night in December 2015, Wells was sitting in his office and playing through a build of Uncharted 4 when he heard his cell phone buzzing and saw a San Francisco number he didn't recognize. It was Sean Layden, the president of Sony Computer Entertainment America and the man in charge of all of Sony's development studios. Layden told Wells he had heard Uncharted 4 needed more time. Then he dropped a megaton. Layden said, "So what if you guys had a ship date in April?" said Wells. And I said, "That would be so awesome." So he said, "You've got it. That'll be your new ship date." Instead of hitting Gold Master by mid-February, they now had until March 18th to fine-tune, fix bugs, and ensure that Uncharted 4 felt polished even without a day one patch. It was, as Wells would later describe it to staff, a Hanukkah miracle. A little while later, a representative of Sony's Europe division came to Wells and asked if Naughty Dog could actually submit the Gold Master on March 15th. Sony was overhauling some manufacturing plants in Europe, the representative said, and in order to print Uncharted 4 on time, they'd need the game 3 days earlier. And we said, "Really?" said Wells. "Those 3 days are huge for us. We really need that time." But Sony Europe had no flexibility. If Naughty Dog needed those extra 3 days, then they'd need to delay Uncharted 4 again, this time to May. It was so frustrating, said Wells, because we were just thinking, oh my gosh, people are going to blame us again, and it was not our fault this time. It was not our fault. But hopefully people have forgotten about that and just remember the game. Getting all that extra time was indeed a Hanukkah miracle for Naughty Dog, but every extra week of development meant an extra week of crunch. It was rough, said Bruce Straley, especially when your brain and your body are saying, I've got just enough for one more week. And you're like, wait, I've got 3 more weeks? That was really hard at the end. But they made it happen, thanks largely to Naughty Dog's collective experience and knowledge of when to stop working on a game. It's the old phrase, art is never finished, it's just abandoned, said Straley. The game is just shipped. That's our motto in that last quarter of production. I walk around just saying, ship it, to everything I see. Ship it! Ship that! And on May 10th, 2016, they shipped it. Uncharted 4 sold 2.7 million copies in a week, received stellar reviews, and was, without a doubt, the most impressive-looking photorealistic game that had been made at that point. In the coming weeks and months, a number of burnt-out developers left Naughty Dog. Others took long vacations and started prototyping for their next two projects, the Uncharted 4 expansion pack, which later morphed into a standalone game called Uncharted: The Lost Legacy, and a sequel to The Last of Us, officially titled The Last of Us Part 2. For these projects, Naughty Dog would have proper pre-production time, and the team wouldn't have to jump right into the fire. "That's why you see everybody happy now," said Bruce Straley when I visited the studio in October 2016. "They're going home at decent hours, coming in at decent hours. They go surfing in the morning."